Welcome, everyone, to our second session on the fascinating Jonathan Edwards with the Reverend Dr. Lou Mitchell. If you missed last week's session or would like to listen to it again, you'll find it on the church website under News and Media. These usually go up on Wednesdays, so if you can share this with your friends. And now, Lou will open us with prayer.
We thank you for this wonderful evening, for this accomplishment. I want to learn from his life and work so that we may serve you and be faithful in this time. Well, today, for the read. Next week, we're going to look at this specific theme. I don't want to keep really talking funny. And this feels like a different thing. So forgive me for that. We're going to look at different specific ideas and how they talk to you within Edward's thought and each respective theology. Next week, we're going to look at what is called the center of the heart. And then the week after that, we're going to look at the idea of beauty, how beauty functions in the theology of the word. We're going to look at the idea of beauty. Can you hear me while we move to double packet?
Thank you. Testing. Now you can hear me, eh? So this week, there are several things I want to do. We had some biography last week. I want to catch up on some of his more personal writings when he was younger. I want to talk about his family a little bit. And then we're going to talk about the Great Awakening. Okay, so that's our task for today. Edwards was a philosopher. And he was really a noted philosopher. And we talked about how he took a lot of personal writings. He did a lot of his writing, exploring of ideas in writing. In 1723, he writes a letter to the Royal Society of London and an associate justice of the Superior Court of Massachusetts. It's the first thing that it's dated October 31st, 1713. And it's called the Spider Letter. What's interesting about this is it shows something, his powers of observation. He was born in 1703, so he's 20 years old at this point. And how he is able to describe what he sees. I know you can't see it, but see, there's a drawing in there and the whole nine yards. And interesting about this letter, I don't believe it got published in the Society, stuff. But for a good while, people thought he wrote this when he was like 10 years old. They go, oh, what a genius. Well, he was a genius, but he didn't write it when he was 10 years old. So even back then, that power of observation enhanced his reputation. I'm going to read excerpt from a couple of what we'll call philosophical private musings, okay? These weren't published. This is written in 1721, and it's called Of Being, B-E-I-N-G. He said this. If you know theology, you'll recognize it as an ontological proof for the existence of God, which we won't probably recognize that. But here we go. That there should absolutely be nothing at all is utterly impossible. Got that? That there should be absolutely nothing. It's absolutely impossible. The mind can never let it stretch its conceptions ever so much, bring itself to conceive of a state of perfect nothing. It puts the mind into mere convulsion and confusion to endeavor to think of such a state, and it contradicts the very nature of the soul to think that it should be nothing. And it is the greatest contradiction, and the aggregate of all contradictions to say that there should not be. Follow that? 'Tis true, we can't so distinctly show the contradiction by words, because we cannot talk about it without speaking horrid nonsense and contradicting ourselves at every word, and because nothing is that whereby we distinctly show other particular contradictions. Okay, how far do I want to read all this stuff? I'll engage that what he means by nothing is as much something as anything that ever he thought of in his life. And I believe that if he knew what nothing was, it would be intuitively evident to him that it could not be. So he goes on to say that there has to be being, because we cannot conceive of a state of perfect nothing, okay? But then he jumps to this. So that we see this necessary eternal being must be infinite and omnipresent. That's where the conclusion he comes up with in his thinking. In other words, if we cannot conceive of a state of perfect nothing, there must be being. And the being must have always existed, or else there would have been nothing. So it must be infinite, and it must be everywhere, because there has to be something everywhere, because you can't have nothing. You follow his thinking? I'm not saying you have to agree with it, but that's his thinking. What I like is he has the line here, kind of, Edwards was so great at images. He says this, but we must think of the same that the sleeping rocks dream of. We must think like the sleeping rocks dream of, and not till then shall we get a complete idea of nothing. I like that. Sleep. Well, we have to put ourselves where the sleeping, with the sleeping rocks dream. Okay. Well, here we go. A little later, he wrote a longer essay called The Beauty of the World. He says this, the beauty of the world consists wholly of sweet mutual consents, either within itself or with the Supreme Being. As to the corporeal world, though there are many other sorts of consent, yet the sweetest and most charming beauty of it is its resemblance of spiritual beauties. Edwards is an idealist, okay? Like Bishop Berkeley was, he believed that the physical world is a shadow or a reflection of the spiritual world, and the spiritual world is the more real world. Follow that? Probably might have heard that before. St. Augustine was an idealist, and it's influenced Christianity and philosophy practically from the beginning. And that's going to play very importantly in along the way. And he was not alone in that. This was not an uncommon philosophy. And he says this, as to the sweetest and most charming beauty of it is its resemblance to spiritual beauties. The reason is that spiritual beauties are infinitely the greatest, and bodies being the shadows of being, they must be so much the more charming as they show forth spiritual beauties. When we talk about the idea of beauty, you'll get this much easier. This beauty is peculiar to natural things. It's surpassing the art of man. And he says this, 'tis very probable that the wonderful suitableness of green, for the color green, for grass and plants, the blue of the sky, the white of the clouds, the colors of flowers consists in a complicated proportion that these colors make one with another, either in the magnitude of rays, the number of vibrations that are caused in the optic nerve, or some other way. The world is full of proportions. In fact, proportion, we're going to see in his philosophy of beauty in particular, plays an absolute critical role. In fact, he comes up with the definition, that being, existence, is proportion. Where there's no proportional relationship, there's no being. We'll get there. But isn't it great to think he thought about stuff like that, and we're today hearing about stuff like that, and maybe next week or the week after, we'll understand a little bit more about that. Now, that's kind of the philosophical stuff he was writing about, but he also had personal writings, like a diary that he kept beginning in 1722. He makes reference says, I do not remember that I experienced regeneration exactly in the steps that were prescribed by the Puritans at that time, the order of salvation. So he makes that comment. In 1722, he's writing that he's not sure that he really experienced the reality of God in regeneration. This is a very religious person. He says this in another entry. I am sometimes apt to think I have a great deal more of holiness than I actually have. He's not alone in that. January 12th, I have this day solemnly renewed my baptismal covenant and self-dedication, which I renewed when I was received into the communion of the church. So he made a serious attempt at some type of renewal. See if I want to say anything more. Okay, I want to look at something that they're published today, and they're used in classes about the Puritans, about Jonathan Edwards. These are called resolutions that he records in 1722. He says this, being sensible that I am unable to do anything without God's help, I humbly entreat him by his grace to enable me to keep these resolutions so far as they are agreeable to his will for Christ's sake. They're kind of like New Year's resolutions. One, he says, is remember to read over these resolutions once a week. Let's hear some of these. resolved never to lose one moment of time, but improve it most profitable way I possibly can. Resolved to live with all my might while I do live. Resolved never to do anything which I should be afraid to do if it
were the morning
hour of my life. Another one. There's a whole bunch. I'm skipping around. Resolved that I will live so as I shall wish I had done when I come to die. Can you follow his grammar? It's a little different grammar and syntax. And instead of doesn't, you'll sometimes hear don't. That's just the way they wrote. Resolved to maintain the strictest temperance in eating and drinking. Resolved to endeavor to obtain for myself as much happiness in the other world as I possibly can, with all the power, might, vigor, and vehemence, yea, violence, I am capable of and can bring myself to exert in any way that can be thought of. His whole focus is on the world to come, right? And trying to make sure that he lives in this world to the best advantage of life in the next world. A couple more resolutions. Resolved to inquire every night as I am going to bed, wherein I have been negligent, what sin I have committed, and wherein I have denied myself also at the end of every week, month, and year. There you go. Resolved never to speak anything that is ridiculous, sportive, or matter of laughter on the Lord's day. No laughing on the Lord's day. No being, what do we want to say? Ridiculous. I would have broken that resolution. As my wife knows, I often say ridiculous things. Resolved to inquire every night before I go to bed whether I have acted in the best way I possibly could with respect to eating and drinking. Resolved frequently to renew the dedication of myself to God, which was made at my baptism, which I solemnly renewed when I was received in communion of the church, in which I have solemnly remade this 12th day of January, 1722. Okay. Almost done. There's a whole bunch of them. I'm not going to read all of them, but a couple more. Resolved that I will act so in every respect as I think I shall wish I had done if I should at last be damned. I frequently hear persons in old age say how they would live if they were to live their lives over again. Resolved that I will live just so as I can think I shall wish I had done, supposing I live to old age. And we're almost there. Resolved always to do that which I shall wish I had done when I see others do it. And last one here, number 70. Let there be something of benevolence in all that I speak. Okay, that's the kind of goals, resolutions that he set himself. He was a very serious young person. In fact, his roommate at Yale didn't get along with him because he was so seriously minded. I think it was one of his cousins too. That he was so serious about everything in life. But you get the kind of picture of the person he was. I don't know if he would be that fun to invite to dinner if he were around today. You better have a temperance in it, I guess. Now, that's really all I want to say about these kind of private writings. There are many, many, many more. Some of them are philosophical. Some of them he just copies sections from a book that he's reading. Sometimes he engages with noted philosophers. I wrote a paper in graduate school about an ad hominem argument between Edwards and David Hume, who was a contemporary. Edwards read Hume. It may be that Hume read a little bit of Edwards, but definitely we know that Edwards read Hume about on the existence of God. So that was an A minus. I thought that wasn't too bad for that. So he sometimes took on noted philosophers, parts of their ideas and all that kind of stuff. But then what we've also seen is this whole range of personal writings. There are a number of letters that we have that he's written. They're just wonderful letters. Every letter is just filled with God and about encouraging the recipient to focus their life on God. There's one letter while Sarah's away, his wife Sarah, where he says something like, "We have come about as long as we can, knowing how to live without you." In other words, get back. Now we take care of all these kids. All right. He writes something very early to Sarah, who was in New Haven, lived in New Haven. Sarah was a Pierpont, which was the Pierponts were among the founding families of New Haven. All right. So she came from a significant family. And when he writes this, she is 13 years old and he is attracted to her. Now he's a young, very young man. Let's see, this is 1723. So he's 20 years old and she's 13 years old. Maybe she's gonna be 14 pretty soon. Listen to what he says about this. Oh, he wrote this on the inside of a Bible and gave it to her, okay? We call it an apostrophe to Sarah Pierpont. I guess it's an alternate meaning for apostrophe. Listen, I'm going to read the whole thing, even though it's almost a whole page here. They say there is a young lady in New Haven who is beloved of that almighty being who made and rules the world. And that there are certain seasons in which this great being, with a capital B, in some way or other invisible, comes to her and fills her mind with exceeding sweet delight. And that she hardly cares for anything except to meditate on him. That she expects after a while to be received up where he is, to be raised up out of the world and caught up into heaven, being assured that he loves her too well to let her remain at a distance from him always. There she is to dwell with him and to be ravished with his love and delight forever. Therefore, if you present all the world before her with the richest of its treasures, she disregards it and cares not for it and is unmindful of any pain or affliction. She has a strange sweetness in her mind and singular purity in her affections, is most just and conscientious in all her actions, and you could not persuade her to do anything wrong or sinful if you would give her all the world, lest she should offend this great being. Not too much more. She is of a wonderful sweetness, calmness, universal benevolence of mind, especially after those seasons in which this great God has manifested himself to her mind. She will sometimes go about from place to place, singing sweetly, and seems to be always full of joy and pleasure. And no one knows for what. She loves to be alone and to wander in the fields and on the mountains. and seems to have someone invisible always conversing with her. That's the end of his of a typical 13-year-old, right? Now, she was an extraordinary young woman, and she grew to be an extraordinary woman. Let me tell you a little bit about the Edwards family. One, like his own family out of which he came, they had 11 kids. 8 females, 3 males. There was envy among many women in town because all of her children survived birth and childhood. Some believe it was because she had a particular keen sense of nutrition and of cleanliness that contributed to that, but they were jealous. Another thing was that it was the belief back then that a child was born on the day of the week on which they were created. Got that? Several of the Edwards kids were born on Sunday, and that got some snickers going. Well, you know, what are they doing between services here, you know? Yeah. One of the kids they talk about was born on a Sunday morning. They brought him right over to church and baptized him and took him home just a short time after he was born. The Edwards family was quite accomplished. We're learning how accomplished Jonathan was, and his children were absolutely the same accomplished. In 1900, it's an old study. An American educator by the name of initials A.E. Winship, W-I-N-S-H-I-P, decided to trace the descendants of Jonathan Edwards almost 150 years after his death. What he also did was he took a notorious family. He calls them the Jukes, J-U-K-E, but their names were changed to protect the guilty, in this case, the innocent. And he follows that family over the same timeline that he follows the Edwards family. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the Jukes. And this is 150 years of study, and it's written in 1900. So there's a lot more, a whole century that one could say. But this is the study, and that's what we have. And I don't think we have anything else like it. The Jukes' descendants included 7 murderers, 60 thieves, 190 prostitutes. This is 1,200 of his descendants. 310, what he calls professional paupers, poor and in the system. 130 convicted criminals. Yeah, I said 170. 170 were women of ill repute, 7 murderers, 60 habitual thieves, and it cost the state what would be the equivalent today of $1,250,000. That's what they cost the state. 20 of them had gainful employment. The Edwards, 11 children. They looked at 1,400 descendants, scores of clergymen, 100 overseas missionaries, 13 presidents of institutions of higher learning, Princeton, Yale, Columbia Law School, and I think there's more. to always mention those, 65 college university professors, at least three governors, Ohio, Connecticut, and South Carolina, 100 lawyers, well, couldn't all be good. They had, no, 30 judges, 66 physicians, plus a dean of medical school, 80 holders of public office, 3 U.S. senators, a controller of the U.S. Treasury, the wife of Theodore Roosevelt was an Edwards descendant, and the vice president of the United States, Aaron Burr. What a distinguished family, especially in comparison with the Jukes. Now, wait just a second. Let's see. Oh, good. Right where we're supposed to be. Any questions or comments so far? This is a transition here. We're gonna go in a different direction. This doesn't work. Oh, you have a microphone. Any questions or comments about anything last week, anything we've covered so far? I guess not. Okay. Very good. Last week, we mentioned that Jonathan Edwards had a key role in one of the most important events of colonial times, pre-American Revolution. And that was what we call the Great Awakening. Revivals were always a part of Puritan tradition. Edwards' father in his church in East Windsor had several times of renewal and revival within the congregation. Edwards would have witnessed this growing up. His grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, who was the preacher at Northampton for many, many years, and who got the nickname Pope Stoddard because he was such a powerful man and controlled much of the Connecticut River Valley. I think I mentioned that to you the last time. Had what he called 5 harvests, like in the fall, you harvest stuff. And so that was known. In the middle colonies, starting in New Brunswick, where Rutgers is, New Brunswick had a very strong Dutch population. In fact, New Brunswick, like many schools, what's the school I'm thinking of in New Brunswick? Rutgers, sorry. Rutgers was founded as a school to train Dutch Reformed ministers, okay? Like many of the schools that were founded to train ministers. Well, there was a particular Dutch preacher in New Brunswick who came out of the Pietist movement in Europe and brought some of the Pietist principles, which were revival and living a sanctified life as much as one could. Brought that to America and brought it to New Brunswick. And his name was, let me see how I can spell it, I won't try, Theodore Frelinghuysen. There it is. You probably never heard of him, but he is significant. And there, his name is around New Brunswick. Well, what's of interest not only of that, it is that Gilbert Tennant, who was one of the leaders of Presbyterianism at the time, who was the son of a man named William Tennant, who founded the Log College. This is review, but I don't expect you to check your notes and all of that. His father started what was called the Log College in Neshaminy, Pennsylvania, Eastern Pennsylvania, to train Presbyterian ministers. That Log College becomes something of a lineage to Princeton and the College of New Jersey. Well, anyway, Gilbert Tennant is greatly influenced by Theodore Frelinghuysen. And Tennant and family begin preaching this kind of revivalist religion in New Jersey and Eastern Pennsylvania. And this is in the mid 1720s, okay? Edwards heard about this, and others did too, and mentions it in some of his writings and mentions Gilbert Tennant by name. Well, Gilbert Tennant, we're going to see, becomes an itinerary. And one of the results of these revivals was that ministers didn't stay in their own pulpits. This becomes a criticism later on. But they went around the area. Some of them extended quite far and preached as guests in other churches, or if they weren't welcome in churches, they preached out in the woods or out in the fields. What we learned last week was that in Northampton, under the preaching of Edwards, a revival starts there in around 1734. It's almost, 10 years after Gilbert Tennant and the Presbyterians are getting into it. And he itinerates around the Connecticut River Valley. So these revivals are what they called awakenings, okay? They called them awakenings because only God can truly revive a sinner. Only God can regenerate a sinner. They called it awakening because the preaching was they're awakening sinners to their condition before God. You follow? So that hopefully they'll do something about it, or hopefully God will then do something about it. So the great awakening is not so much everything is conversions, and it's what we would call, quote unquote, a Calvinist theology awakening, okay? What sinners could do is they could take steps to put themselves in the way of God. Like they could go to church, they could go to church and worship. They could read the Bible. They could pray. But there was no guarantee that they would be converted. In fact, they sometimes use the term hypocrites in a little different way than we use hypocrites. We tend to use the word hypocrite of someone who pretends to be something and knows they're not. They used it as people who thought they were converted genuinely, but weren't, okay? They talk about hypocrites. There's a difference. The hypocrite in the religious sense is not understanding their true condition. Okay. So there are these revivals, we'll call awakenings, going on in New Jersey, in Eastern Pennsylvania, in the Connecticut River Valley. Well, it all starts to come to a head beginning in 1739, when an associate of John Wesley in England and the Welsh revivals, a man by the name of George Whitefield, arrives in America. He goes first to the South. He's in Georgia. He is moved to start an orphanage in Georgia. And a lot of his itinerating was to raise money for that orphanage. He is called the Grand Itinerant because he he comes back in 1740 and spends time in New England. And this is where his reputation starts to skyrocket. I want to talk a little bit about him. In 1740, George Whitefield spent 45 days in New England, 40 towns, including Northampton. He preached in Jonathan Edwards' Northampton twice, and Edwards cried all through. He swept like a baby, it says. He was so excited and so happy to see the one whom God was working through. In those 45 days, he preached 97 sermons. He spent 11 days in Boston, and when he left, he preached to 20,000 people on Boston Common. At a time he comes back to Boston, the number goes to 30,000 people. Now, what's amazing is that he could be heard, that he had a voice that would carry so that 20, 30, whatever thousands of people could hear him. One of the biographies of him, they call him the divine dramatist because he's the first to start using some particular principles. One of them is he advertises. Word gets around. Whitefield's on his way. He's going to be here. That's new. That didn't happen before. The other thing is he used acting and stage presence in his explication of the Bible. It was said that people would cry. He could get people to cry just by the way he said Mesopotamia. And by crying? No. He would do stuff like this. This was Whitefieldian. He'd be out there preaching. He'd go up, very dramatically, "Father Abraham," up in heaven. "Yes, my son." "Are there any Catholics in heaven?" "No, my son." "Are there any Anglicans in heaven?" "No, my son." "Any Methodists?" "No." "Any Presbyterians?" "No." "Well, what do you got?" kind of thing. "We only have Christians in heaven." Okay, see that? That's very Whitefieldian. Now, when he was speaking in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin went to hear him because he had heard of his reputation as an orator. After this, Franklin and Whitfield become friends, and they have a wonderful correspondence throughout the years. These are the words of Ben Franklin. By the way, Whitfield's years were 1714, and he died in 1770. He's buried, in a Presbyterian church in Newbury, Massachusetts, right on Route 1, right on the water, if you care to know that. He says this. I happened soon after to attend one of his sermons, says Franklin, in the course of which I perceived he intended to finish with a collection. And I silently resolved he should get nothing from me. I had in my pocket a handful of copper money, 3 or 4 silver dollars, and 5 pistoles in gold. As he proceeded, I began to soften and concluded to give him the coppers. Another stroke of his oratory made me ashamed of that and determined me to give the silver. And he finished so admirably that I emptied my whole pocket in it, in the collector's dish, gold and all. That's how impressive Franklin was. Now, when Franklin left Boston that first time, 20,000 people on the common, he met, coming towards Boston, Gilbert Tennent, the Presbyterian revivalist and itinerary. And Whitfield encouraged him to go at him again. And so Gilbert Tennent did. Gilbert was born in 1741 in Ireland, coming to America. Whitfield said this about Tennant. He went to the bottom, indeed, and did not dab with uninterrupted mortar. Hypocrites must either soon be convicted or enraged at his preaching. He is a son of thunder. That's what Whitfield called him, Barnabas, a son of thunder. And I find doth not fear the faces of men. In 1 week in New Haven, Tennant preached 17 sermons, including at the college as well. His most particular emphasis and sermon was called The Danger of an Unconverted Ministry. He went around asking lay people to consider the spiritual condition of their pastors. That went over big. In fact, that was one of the big criticisms of the Great Awakening in here. And it led, I would say, it led to the founding of Princeton in this way. Let's see, how much time do we have? Oh, not that much. Okay. Do I want to tell you about David Brainerd or not? Okay, I want to make sure that I give you this information about the Great Awakening. Okay, so I'm talking about the effect of the Great Awakening now. As a religious event, it is undoubtedly the most momentous occasion in the spiritual life of colonial America. But equally important are the social and political repercussions. One of them was pastoral authority, and thus authority of those, quote unquote, in authority. Huge audiences met in unprecedented popular assemblies out in the woods because they wouldn't let them in the church. And the traditional of concept of social order and political authority was under challenge. This laid the groundwork that, well, lay people could exhort now. So pastoral authority is being challenged. Women talk about spiritual experiences with women, and that wasn't done. So it starts, free speech becomes, the right of assembly starts here. Free speech, clerical itinerary, lay exhorting, women, dissenter churches begin to develop here. And what happens is there's a groundwork for the first time. This is the first intercolonial event. The first journal in the New World called Christian History is founded to chronicle what's going on. Edwards' writings chronicle what's going on. People want to know what's going on. They want to hear about it. Whitfield went all over the colonies. And there were other evangelists who went. Let me read this. This is Harry Stout, who was a professor at Yale. Now he's a professor emeritus, says this. In terms of social and political effects, the rhetorical transformations wrought in the Great Awakening signified an emerging popular culture asserting itself against a paternalistic social ethic. Big words, but I think you get the point. Of course, this was not the conscious intent of the revivalists, whose primary concern was the saving of souls. Nevertheless, in the course of organizing their revivals, they unleashed democratic forces that would spill over into a broad range of political contexts in the course of wars with France and England. Changes wrought in pulpit style would be applied to political oratory, and the lessons learned in the revivals would be applied to the task of popular mobilization for revolt. Considered as a social event, the Great Awakening signified nothing less than the first stage of the American Revolution. Okay, I think I'll end there rather than try to just talk fast and squeeze more in, and let you, if you have any questions or comments about this whole thing, the great importance of the great awakening. Yeah. Okay. By the way, later under Finney, there were some sections where so many evangelists came through that in upstate New York they called it the burned over district. Yeah.
Did Thomas Jefferson say anything about Jonathan Edwards?
Not that I know of. It's quite possible he probably heard about him. But I don't have anything there. If you go, you can go on. There is a Jonathan Edwards Center at Yale that has everything of his writings, and you can go on, Google it, and they have a search engine where you could ask a question like that, and it would tell you. And if there was, they would tell you. They would bring it up and tell you how to find it. Okay. Yeah.
Pardon me for asking kind of a crass question.
All right.
But what was their financial support? You mentioned Franklin being moved to contribute whatever was in his pocket. So yeah. Was it that kind of
Oh, yeah.
income?
Yeah, he raised money that way. Well, I mean, you figure if there are 10,000 people giving you a lot of money, you know, back in that time, you probably did. But he was a man of integrity. He sent it to the orphanage that he developed in Georgia. The other event, well, some of the evangelists were supported by missionary societies, supported them. This guy named David Brainerd, I was going to talk about more, a disciple of Jonathan Edwards, did that. There was a Scottish organization for the perpetuation of the gospel. They were the ones that paid his salary, which really wasn't very much. Anything else?
Apparently in 1791, Jonathan Edwards sent Thomas Jefferson a copy of The Salvation of All Men Strictly Examined.
That might have been Jonathan Edwards Jr., because he died in 1758.
Could be.
There was a Jonathan Edwards Jr. that succeeded him, and that was more than likely him.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah. The thing continues. Is that it? Are we good to go? Peace, love, joy. Thank you. Next week, a sense of the heart.